Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The shadowy secrets of the U.S. housing market on the program today. What do you do with a stolen Picasso anyway? Also, a little bit of Freakonomics Radio for you from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts designed with convenient features to help reach savings goals. To learn more or open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 17th of October. Good to have you with us, as always. Today's main economic number, housing starts, brings with it a certain economic conundrum. We learned this morning new home construction for September was the highest we've seen in 4 years, a nifty 34% jump from last year. Therein, though, lies the mystery, because with all the foreclosures out there that we've all been hearing so much about, houses just ready and willing to be sold, why is anybody building new homes again? We sent Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji to find out.
Who knows what mysteries wait in the darkness? Who knows what terrors prowl in the underworld?
Who knows how many properties are in the process of foreclosure or bank-owned?
The Shadow knows.
The Shadow inventory, that is.
The Shadow inventory has really been drawn down and has become much less scary than it appeared a couple years ago.
Darren Bloomquist is the vice president of Realty Track, a foreclosure tracking firm. He says bank-owned properties are down 48% from January 2011, when they were at their peak. Stephen Paul, executive vice president of Mid-Atlantic Builders in Maryland, says he's no longer afraid of competition from a shadow inventory of used homes. Paul says this past summer was the best they've had in 7 years. But he adds there's a new shadow lurking.
The new concern, cost increases on the wholesale side for materials, drywall and concrete and steel.
He says he hasn't seen those cost increases yet, but thinks they're inevitable as fuel prices keep rising. Paul spoke with me from a conference of home builders and says they're not impressed with the housing starts.
We're just a skeptical, rough kind of group where we're not impressed by much.
And Nick Ritsinas from the Harvard Business School says that skepticism makes sense.
These numbers, which again are pretty dramatic increases, but dramatic increases because we started with a low base.
Ritsinas says we need over 1 million new homes built a year to be at pre-recession, pre-bubble levels. With these new starts, we're still around 200,000 short. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Say what you will about Lance Armstrong, and many people have said a whole lot the past couple of weeks. You do have to admit he's pulled off a neat trick. Even amid his own professional disgrace, his charity has managed to thrive. Armstrong stepped down as the chairman of the Livestrong Foundation this morning. Nike and a couple of others canceled its personal contract with him, but Nike said it would continue to support Livestrong. It is, as Marketplace's Eve Tro explains, all about the brand.
The website Charity Navigator rates causes for people who want to give 0 to 4 stars. How's Livestrong stack up?
They get 4 stars. It's one of our higher rated charities and has been for some time.
President Ken Berger says Livestrong is in the top 1% of charities. It raises tens of millions of dollars a year to support cancer patients. Berger says when a charity's charismatic leader is disgraced, the charity usually suffers horribly or just folds.
What's really unusual here is that we don't see that. In fact, there's been a slight uptick in its donations.
That's likely due to years of rebranding the Lance Armstrong Foundation as simply Livestrong. Look at anything Livestrong, a charity road race, those yellow wristbands, and you likely see Lance Armstrong only in the fine print, if at all. Even as Nike condemned Armstrong today, the company affirmed its commitment to selling Livestrong products.
It's much, much bigger than even just cancer at this point.
Brand analyst Paul Swinand at Morningstar says a look at Livestrong.com makes that clear.
It's become really a self-help site and really an internet information brand.
An internet search for anything body-related is likely to bring up a Livestrong article or video.
Hi, I'm Amber Namides with Livestrong.com, and I'm going to teach you how to naturally enlarge your glutes.
Welcome to Livestrong.com, it says. Let us be your personal guide to becoming a better, healthier you. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Wall Street took a breather today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Immigration policy came up for a spell in the debate last night. It was one of the 11 questions asked of President Obama and Governor Romney. Immigration is of particular concern to a grocery chain in Northern California called Mi Pueblo. It's Latino-owned. Most of its workers are also Latino. And after being picked for a federal immigration audit, it's about to discover which of those workers are undocumented. Julia Scott has the story.
The atmosphere is always muy animado at Mi Pueblo Foods, a specialized grocery chain that sells Mexican fare to Northern California Latinos. Until recently, Mi Pueblo was a standout success story. It's the fastest growing supermarket chain in the region. Its 21 stores added 1,600 employees during the recession alone. Now the company, headquartered in San Jose, faces the prospect of a mass layoff, a boycott, and a federal audit of its employee immigration forms.
The company has no knowledge of anyone being undocumented, but you really don't know till you get the list.
Julie Pace is a workplace attorney Mi Pueblo hired earlier this month when it announced an employee records inspection by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE. ICE will comb the company's records to uncover fraudulent information like fake Social Security numbers. Mi Pueblo also joined E-Verify, which checks the immigration status of new employees. Based on her experience, Pace says as much as 90% of Mi Pueblo's workforce may need to be replaced, but it could also be very few.
Why, Mi Pueblo? Why, when it's the fabric of our Latino communities, is it being targeted?
ICE says it doesn't target companies for audits, but acts on tips it receives from the public or other agencies. ICE has done 9,000 audits since President Obama took office. Based on experience, immigrants may lose their jobs, but they won't be deported. But people are scared. Rosa Gomez is an immigration attorney based in East Palo Alto. She says Mi Pueblo employees are quitting their jobs before they get fired.
People who have worked there 5 years are just leaving now in fear and not getting any sort of compensation or anything like that.
It's ironic for Mi Pueblo to defend itself from charges of betraying employees and siding with the federal government. The company was founded by a former janitor who came to the U.S. from Mexico without legal documents. Now the grocery chain faces a boycott from the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 5. The union has tried to organize workers at Mi Pueblo for more than a decade.
We're on the side of the workers.
Union rep Mike Hennebury.
We're trying to stop this audit. We're trying to keep families together. Mi Pueblo is not doing that. They should be doing that. And they're going to be boycotted for not doing that.
But this is more than a PR challenge for the grocery chain. The 8 million undocumented workers in this country aren't just the ones staffing local stores like Mi Pueblo. They're also reliable customers. In San Francisco, I'm Julia Scott for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, it's good to have you back.
Kai Rizdal, thank you for having me back.
You're very welcome.
I know we're all excited about the second presidential debate last night, yes?
Yeah, it was a good one, don't you think? Interesting.
It was a lot of, I thought, scintillating talk about taxation in particular.
You need to get out more, but okay.
Turn you. It did get me to thinking, however, about lying. Now,
wow.
I don't mean the lying of the sort that each campaign is accusing the other of doing every 2 seconds. I mean, Kai, lying to ourselves.
All right. Go ahead, because I don't know. I have no idea where you're going.
All right. Let me explain.
Okay.
A couple weeks ago, I saw a poll on Yahoo Finance. It asked people – it said that France's wealthiest man is talking about leaving the country to avoid high taxes there. Would you ever leave the U.S., it asked, to avoid high taxation?
Okay.
Now, about a third of the respondents to this poll said no. I would never leave. But everyone else was willing to entertain the idea. In fact, another third said they would leave the U.S. if taxes were to go higher than even 40%, which isn't really that much of a stretch.
From where they are now. All right, so this I'm going to show off here. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right, so this is the Laffer curve, right? Arthur Laffer, the economist, and he said, you know, it in theory shows the
Bingo.
Point at which high taxes make people stop trying to work hard and make money.
That is the theory.
Uh-huh.
The Laffer curve theory is a bit, however, like a unicorn. We don't really know
Come on,
where that cutoff
real.
Point is. They sometimes they may be. In California, where you
That's
live,
right.
I think more real than in some places. I did ask my economist co-author, Steve Levitt,
Yes.
what he would do if, for instance, he had to pay, let's say, 50% in taxes.
All right.
I wouldn't leave the U.S., but I definitely would work less hard. Maybe not at 50%, but at 70 or 80%, I would spend a lot more time playing golf and a lot less time trying to make money, that's for sure.
Oh, please. First of all, the man has what, 4 or 5 children? How are you going to feed 4 or 5 kids making less money?
Okay.
Here's what I think. I think he's an economist and he sees this theory, and so he's talking to the theory.
I wouldn't say you're wrong there, but let me also say this. We lie to ourselves all the time. We're constantly trying to predict how we're going to behave in the future in the, you know, when something happens, a tax hike, a price change, a presidential election, and we're almost always wrong. you take something as simple as driving, okay? AAA, the American Automobile Association, is constantly surveying drivers. They'll say something like, you know, if gas prices stay this as high as they are now, go up, will you drive less? And people always say, oh, absolutely. And then you look at the data, and they do not drive less. Here's Joel Weichsel with AAA.
I think there may be people who lie to themselves or imagine that they're doing something that they're not. But I think there are also people who maybe forget about things that they've done.
Forget it. He's being very polite and just saying we're lying to ourselves. That's what he's saying. Right?
It's a synonym.
That's right.
But I will say this. I don't believe it's necessarily intentional, okay? One problem with any survey is that the power of suggestion comes into play.
All right, so, well, let's get it back to the debate then, Dubner, and talk about this idea of polling and people lying to themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, do political polls change behavior, do you think?
Quite possibly, and also we're probably just getting a lot of answers that don't reflect reality, okay? You think about it. What every poll relies on is one stranger telling the truth to another stranger about the future, okay?
Yeah.
So there are many ways in which that answer can go wrong.
Yeah.
Nate Silver runs the blog 538.com.
Yep. Yeah, we had him on a couple weeks ago.
He takes all these different political polls and analyzes them and weights them depending on how good a poll they are. He says, Nate Silver says, it can be hard even to figure out whether a given person will vote at all.
You can ask Americans and say, are you going to vote? But people lie about that, just like they lie about always washing their hands or using condoms or never running a red light or anything else.
I don't even know what to make of this.
Are you depressed
yet,
Kai?
Is hope lost for being able to do this kind of stuff?
I wouldn't say hope is quite lost, but I will say this. The cardinal rule should be don't listen to what people say, right?
Yeah.
Watch what they do. So the next time you hear, you know, a friend of yours say, oh, man, if that guy gets elected president, I am out of here. I'm moving to Canada. You go and check back in a year or so. I promise you the odds are pretty good he hasn't budged an inch, Kai.
Stephen Dubner, he'll be back in a couple of weeks. Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you, man, if you're still in the country.
Thanks, Kai.
See ya. Coming up.
We bought that one for like $40, which, you know, I'd say for the amount of buzz that it's produced, I think that was a pretty good investment.
Bindersfullofwomen.com for reals. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial has inched up 5 points today, a fraction of 1%, 13,557 the number. The NASDAQ added 2 points, a tenth percent, 3104. The S&P 500 ticked up 5 points, 0.4%. 1460. Surprisingly good numbers for new home construction today. As I said, Pulte Group thus climbed 5%. D.R. Horton erected a 4% increase. Lennar and Toll Brothers each rose about 2% or so. Bank of America sank 0.2%. Had another profitable quarter, but despite the good housing news today, said it still has to wade through a bunch of troubled mortgages. One day after its CEO stepped down, Citigroup rose another 3%. Today, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.82%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank, FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts with a competitive variable interest rate and convenient access via phone or web. Link your existing bank accounts without switching banks. To learn how this FDIC-insured high-yield savings account can complement your savings goals and to open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators for September. Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Chuck Berry turns 86. And the state nicknamed The Last Frontier celebrates a holiday. Alaska Day marks the anniversary of the transfer of the Alaska Territory from Russia to the U.S. in 1867. The price? 2 cents an acre. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. When California voters make their way to the polls 3 weeks from now, we're going to be choosing more than just politicians out here. Love it or hate it, California lets voters make law directly through ballot propositions. This year, one of those propositions would require labels on some foods that contain genetically engineered ingredients. GMOs is the common phrase. The proposition has brought in tens of millions of dollars in campaign contributions, much of it from big-name companies like Monsanto, DuPont, and Pepsi, all of whom are on the no side. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains why those labels are such a big deal.
Proposition 37 either
gives us the right to know if there are genetically engineered ingredients in our food with clear information on package labels.
Or it's a complex, badly written labeling proposition that makes no sense.
And that's just the beginning of the back and forth about pretty much everything. If there's a reason to worry about GMO foods, how the law will work, what the labels really tell us, and what it might cost shoppers.
We estimate that the cost to the average California household would be between $350 and $400 per year.
Kevin Deatley is with Northbridge Environmental Management Consultants, a firm hired by the No on Prop 37 people to evaluate costs. Now, one big assumption he makes in getting to that number, companies won't want to put a label on their products that says this:
partially produced with genetic engineering.
So they'll swap out genetically engineered ingredients for more expensive organic and non-GMO ingredients. Consider, Deatley says, mandatory GMO labeling laws in Europe.
We certainly don't know what will happen, but looking at what has happened in Europe and other places, companies have worked to avoid using the labels, primarily because the labels don't convey much useful information and can be, frankly, frightening to people.
Emory University professor Joanna Shepherd-Bailey isn't so sure.
For very important reasons, America is very different than the European market. Specifically, American consumers have been far more inclined to eat genetically engineered food than European consumers for decades, really.
She wrote the cost estimate the pro-labeling group cites and thinks companies will just put labels on and get on with it. Total cost to California families, she says, less than $2.
And that's basically assuming that the food producers passed on all of the cost of redesigning labels.
So why a label? Most reputable science and many national and global health groups say genetically engineered foods on the market are safe to eat. So why a label? The pro-labeling side says it's simple. People have a right to know what's in their food. But the millions being spent on this measure have a lot to do with exactly how that label will change the behavior of people and companies. Experts I talked to seem to think the people who don't want to eat GMOs are likely to spend a lot of time label spotting. Other people, they're just not going to care. But what about the people who take time to read the label and don't really know what it means?
They might view it as a warning.
Jill McCluskey is a professor at Washington State University. The FDA has signed off on GMOs, but McCluskey says a mandatory label, that might send a different signal.
If the government now requires consumers to be informed that their products have GM ingredients, I think they may choose to avoid them.
Industry analyst Gary Karp at Technomic thinks the pressure on food manufacturers to rework foods could be pretty intense if Prop 37 passes. Even if the group that wants to avoid GMOs is a lot smaller than the group that doesn't.
If 75% or 95% of people really don't care, then they don't care one way or the other. And so the small minority, really tend to make an impact.
If you care, you really care.
What I'll call the vocal minority tends to be very passionate about what they believe, and they make a disproportionate amount of press and what I'll call, not derogatorily, but I'll just call, you know, noise.
Which is going to make it tough for food producers to figure out how to respond. Karp says they want to meet the needs of their customers, but...
What they like to do, though, is to know that it is a large group of their consumers as opposed to a vocal portion of the consumers.
Most of the people I talk to expect that if Proposition 37 passes, at least some food companies will change what's in their foods. Possibly for everyone, not just California. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
There's an art museum in the Netherlands that's got some empty spaces on its gallery walls today. Last night, thieves made off with as much as 100 million euros. It's about $130 million or so, worth of priceless paintings. A Picasso, a couple of Monets, a Gauguin as well. But now that they've got them, what are they going to do with them? Robert Whitman is an art security consultant. He used to run the FBI's art crime team. Mr. Whitman, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Kai. It's great to be here.
Well, first things first, these guys have these paintings. What are they going to do with them?
Well, the problem is going to be that. What I always say is with these individuals is they're very good criminals, but they're terrible businessmen. So they're going to go out, they're going to steal these things, they're actually going to plan it, and then they're going to take them somewhere and hide them, and then they're going to try to find a buyer. And that's where they're going to find out they're going to run into a big problem.
Why is it such a problem? I mean, these are ostensibly valuable things.
Well, Kai, you have to understand, when it comes to the art market, there's three things that make a painting valuable. It's authenticity, provenance, but it's also a legitimate title on a piece of artwork. These paintings do have that. They are authentic, but of course, these guys don't have legal title. That knocks out all the value.
The thing that gets me, though, is that the return on investment in this is now so low, because in theory, they've spent time planning it. They've spent time acquiring equipment and training and casing the joint and all that other stuff, and they go into it blind, basically.
Yeah, these were not art thieves. All right, these guys were a bunch of criminals who were involved in many different types of criminal enterprises, such as car theft, you know, dealing in drugs, gun running, and this just happened to be the latest job that they did. They're not going in, you know, and doing these elaborate heists like Thomas Crown at the movies. It's not like that.
It's not possible that no stolen painting has ever been sold, right? I mean, it must happen.
Oh, it happens, yeah. Stolen paintings are sold, you know, inadvertently. Sometimes people buy them by not, and they don't know that these pieces are stolen. But we're not talking about masterpieces. We're not talking about multi-million dollar items. We're talking about pieces that are much cheaper, much smaller, and that, you know, that don't hit the art market the way these have.
These paintings that were stolen last night, if you're right and they're not going to be sold, what's going to happen to them?
Well, I think that they're going to go into hiding. They're going to be probably in people's closets and behind furniture for the next couple of months or 6 months or so. And then you'll see some nibbles at possibly some ransom type of attempts. And then eventually they'll come back to market and be recovered.
Do you think so? You're confident they'll come back?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I'm probably 90% sure, to be honest with you, that these pieces will be back at some point. I mean, it might take a few years, but eventually they all come back because, let's face it, you know, these outlive all of us. We're here for short amounts of time. These paintings are here for centuries, some of them.
Robert Whitman, founded the FBI's art crime team. He's got a book about his life doing this stuff. It's called Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. Mr. Whitman, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Kai, thank you so much. It's great to speak to you.
Along with the voters and the pundits and the press, there was another group paying close attention to that debate last night, just waiting for their chance to capitalize on what exactly they didn't know until Governor Romney talked about trying to get gender balance in his cabinet in Massachusetts.
I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women.
And thus was born an internet meme. Sally Herships takes it from there.
If you don't think a lot of people are talking about Romney and his binders, listen to how this interview started.
So basically, the story is pegged to Romney's comment last night.
Binders.
That's Alex Nagel. He works for Trender, a social media measurement platform. And holy Shazam, Batman! The buzz today is all about binders. There are untold binder tweets, a Binders Full of Women Facebook page, and one on Tumblr. But can people make money off of this?
Do you remember the Neon Cat? It was that little loop of the Pop-Tart cat with the catchy little obsessive jingle behind it.
The Pop-Tart Cat animation on YouTube has over 86 million views. You can buy Pop-Tart Cat t-shirts and bracelets at stores like Hot Topic. Overnight internet sensations like these are called memes, and they can make money. But they have to move fast. Take bindersfullofwomen.com. That page is full of anti-Romney messages brought to you by American Bridge 21st Century, a Democratic super PAC. It was ready to get the domain because it had staffers watching the debate ready to pounce on any URL. Rodel Molyneux is the super PAC's president.
We bought that one for like $40, which, you know, I'd say for the amount of buzz that it's produced, I think that was a pretty good investment.
Whether that $40 persuades any new voters remains to be seen. Again, Alex Nagel.
It's Warhol on steroids. Andy Warhol famously said everyone will be famous for 15 minutes at some point.
Hashtag fame is fleeting. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today from New York City, word of a plot, a foiled plot, I should say, to blow up the New York Fed. The FBI says it's arrested a 21-year-old Bangladeshi man after they say he tried to detonate what he thought was a 1,000-pound bomb in a van parked outside the Fed building in Lower Manhattan. The FBI had it under control the whole time, apparently. The guy was using inert materials he'd been given by undercover FBI agents to make the bomb. Still, scary stuff, huh? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow inched up 5 points, fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ added 2 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500 ticked up 5 points, 0.4% there. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lynch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.